Hey, Michelle, are you there?
I'm here. Are you there?
So, we should introduce ourselves.
Okay.
I'm Michelle Goldberg, a freelance writer for a number of places, including both the New Republic on occasion, often the Daily Beast, and I'm also an author, most recently, of The Means of Reproduction, Sex, Power, and the Future of the World.
All right, I'm much easier. I'm Michelle Cottle, and I've been a senior editor at the New Republic for over a decade now, writing about everything but mostly kind of Washington politics stuff.
Although we were saying we're going to start by talking about something, there's like actually remarkably little going on in Washington politics right now. So we were going to talk about this New York article.
Yes, it's something that both of us, I think, are kind of obsessed with, but coming at from completely different reasons. It's the cover story that Jen Senior did on why parents love their children but really hate parenting.
Go ahead. Tell me why you're obsessed with it, because one of the things that I find so curious and also a little bit sad, because I am obsessed with these articles. I read them incessantly. And then I tend to read the comments, which I rarely do on anything else. And there's this real, I'm not sure if it's misunderstanding or hostility or one shading into the other, often between the reactions of parents and non-parents, that I think is kind of unfortunate. Tell me why you are obsessed with these kind of articles.
Well, I didn't read the comments for this, so let me back up and get you to explain. Are the parents offended by these and the non-parents confused, or kind of what are you finding?
Well, you know, I'm not even talking about this specific article, but I really read in part because, you know, it's interesting. She mentions in the New York article, she mentions a book called Maybe Baby.
Mm-hmm.
That book actually stemmed from an article I wrote maybe 7 years ago when I was working at Salon.com, and we were having kind of an internal discussion about how difficult it is to decide whether or not to have children. And from that discussion, we decided to do a series of essays, which I kicked off, and then Lori Leibovich, who I worked at Salon with, turned it into a book. And so this question of whether or not to have children is something that I've been thinking about for many years, and I'm kind of no closer to resolution on, even though, you know, eventually biology will resolve it for me one way or the other. So both on my articles and the Salon series and all the other ones, and then everything I've read about the happiness research that comes after, you know, and these articles are fairly perennial, although I think Jennifer Senior's was one of the best. There's a breakdown. There's often women, often mothers will say, you know, what these kind of happiness studies don't capture is the sense of satisfaction or the kind of, you know, love or even the existential relief of knowing what your life is about. But among fathers, there's not universally, but among fathers, there's often a real, like, well, you selfish bitches don't know what you're missing to the single women. and meanwhile, the childless people can often be really defensive, you know, and use words like breeders and spawn and veer into what almost seems to be maybe like a weird kind of conservatism in that they, you know, kind of complain about having to pay taxes to fund public schools, or they complain about, you know, parents not pulling their weight at work. They just it always becomes adversarial, and it always makes me really sad, because I actually, although I'm still, like I said, I'm not really any closer to a decision, I wish that there could be maybe more of a united front between mothers and women who don't have children, rather than seeing kind of public resources as a zero-sum situation.
Well, I think part of that is that there's not even a united front among mothers. I mean, once you wind up with the kids, then you get to have the mommy wars fight of this. Nothing makes people crazier than this decision. And I think one of the things that Jen gets at in this piece is, nobody did the research that much years ago, because that's just what moms did. I mean, women oftentimes went straight from living at home with their parents to getting married and having kids, and now you have all these options, and, you know, everybody, there is no one right way to do this, and so everybody gets very defensive about kind of whether they're being judged by people who've made other choices and along those lines. But the phenomenon you're talking about of, like, childless people versus parents reminds me, years ago, Marjorie Williams, who wrote an op-ed column for The Post, wrote this piece, and she did parent writing and kind of life writing better and less kind of gooey sentimentally than almost anybody. And she had a column that basically started out with, you know, all of her single and childless coworkers were always complaining about how parents got to leave early for ball games and got priority for vacation days. And they're like, well, you know, what's in this for us? You know, what about we who don't have kids? And Marjorie's answer was basically like, well, you don't have kids. I mean, that's what you
that's get a what life for you
that basically gets to revolve around your preferences. And I think one of the things that gets people really going is kind of the sense that single, childless people don't necessarily kind of grasp how big the life change is. I mean, for people these days, getting married is nothing. I mean, basically, especially for people who live together, there's very little life shift between when you are living together and when you get married. But no matter how many times people warn you about the life shift before parenthood to being a parent, it still kind of hits you between the eyes. And so what I tend to find, and this may be kind of like the great conspiracy that parents, secret conspiracy that moms have that they don't necessarily share with childless women, is that we read these pieces and we're like, oh my God, yeah. You know, to some degree, that's true. I mean, life is fabulous. You love your children. You know, you'd lie down on railroad tracks for them. But they make you so deeply, deeply crazy a lot of the time. And it's just, you know, it's not one of those jobs that you can put aside at some point. I mean, they make you crazy 24/7. And especially my friends who tend to be like type A neurotic personalities anyway. On some level, it's just not healthy. It's just you can't worry that much all the time.
But in terms of happiness, I mean, the kinds of happiness that these studies measure, and they all are structured in different ways, and it's never quite clear to me whether they're measuring kind of happiness or, you know, day-to-day pleasure. Because on the one hand, if somebody asked me to, you know, monitor my moods by the hour, I would probably be a lot happier when I'm out drinking with my friends, or going to, you know, or even like watching like bad Law and Order reruns on the couch with my husband than when I'm writing books. But that doesn't mean that would be a more rewarding or better way to spend my life, right? And writing books, I mean, I've written two books, I'm working on my third. I'm not trying to compare it to parenthood, except that it's, you know, often a terrible, miserable grind. You'd rather be doing anything else. It frustrates you. You have, like, very little control, ultimately, over what happens to your book once it's launched into the world. And the whole thing is, you know, kind of anxiety and anticlimax, you know, mixed with a few moments of real satisfaction. And yet, to me, it's kind of self-evidently worth doing, nonetheless.
Yeah,
but I'm not sure...
I think that Jen gets at this. It's really hard to have some kind of empirical gauge of what it means to be happy. And I think a lot of these studies, and as you say, this is a perennial topic, a lot of these studies do kind of try to measure moment-to-moment happiness, which, you know, when I've done columns about this, it's not exactly kind of the difference between happiness and joy, but it is a little bit similar to that, whereas, you know, obviously cleaning up vomit or blood or staying up all night because somebody's got a 103-degree fever is not going to make you happy from moment to moment. But then again, you know, you don't love anybody like you love your kids on some level. It's one of those things where you're comparing apples to oranges. And I do think that's why the difference would be larger perhaps now when you have people who have a whole, you know, 10 or 15 years because they've delayed a childhood where they remember what it's like to be able to stay out all night or go to Afghanistan to cover a war, or, you know, fly off to ski in the Alps or whatever at a moment's notice, as opposed to suddenly living for someone else. So it is kind of a distinction there between kind of what happiness is versus what, you know, kind of long-term joy or satisfaction, or you were talking about kind of, and I think Jen gets at the whole idea of kind of having a purpose in life.
And when you were talking before about who, what was the writer you were talking about? Marjorie?
Marjorie Williams.
Well, you said, you know, what do you get out of it? And she says, well, you, or, you know, what's in it for me? And she said, you don't have kids. I mean, but if everything that you're saying is the truth, it would seem that people with children would pity those without them.
No, I mean, I think there's a, it's all comes down to kind of, it's not even really priorities, but, and maybe as you, your kids get older and you're not in the thick of it. I mean, I've got a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old, and so daily life is really chaotic. Mm-hmm. Now, nobody can make me cry or laugh or just be completely blissed out. And I adore my husband, but it's not exactly the same kind of thing, you know, quite like my kids do. But at the same time, you know, you turn into your mother. You're like, you say no, stop that 30,000 times a day, you know. Get your finger out of your nose, stop drooling on the furniture, stop breaking things. You spend an awful lot of time doing that. And that's even when things are just going completely smoothly. You know, mm-hmm. The kind of day-to-day grind is such that I am not one of these people who's like, oh, you have to have kids or your life's going to be so empty. No, you know, a lot of people, I know people who never had kids, and while, you know, some of them are maybe kind of sad, others of them are like, great, you know, they hold hands all the time and go off on romantic vacations and, you know, write novels and do all these kind of fabulous things that other people are just too damn tired to do. It's just one of those things. So, again, it's everybody wants to think that there's one great right way, and I think what makes me sad about these wars and the mommy wars kind of more mm-hmm. narrowly is there's just not. I mean, there's no, obviously the species relies on certain people, you know, turning into breeders. But, you know, individually speaking, it's not for everybody.
So why do you think there's so much, I mean, I don't think that these would be so fraught if kind of everybody wasn't afraid that they're doing it wrong or making the wrong decisions or, you know, or kind of being judged. I mean, you don't really mind, in my experience, you don't really mind being judged for things that you're completely secure about. You know, people mostly seem to fear being judged when they feel like there might be a grain of truth to the other person's observations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's certainly the case when you get down into the nitty-gritty of the mommy wars. I mean, everybody obsesses about every study that comes out over, you know, is daycare going to knock one IQ point off my child or make them marginally less likely to get into Harvard, or mm-hmm. is, you know, should I stay home, and is that going to make my daughter think that mommies should always stay home? I mean, those kind of things, I think, really purely stem from just kind of fear and anxiety over what's the right thing to do. Especially among kind of upper middle class professional women who bring to parenting the same kind of psycho drive they bring to their careers. It's totally not healthy. And on some level, I'm sure it becomes the same kind of issue about whether even to have a child. I mean, mm-hmm. we have so many choices, and we've been told that feminism and women's empowerment is about being able to make your choice. But some women just can't stand the idea that their choice isn't the one that everybody's made. They just can't quite come to terms with that. No matter which way you go, you're always going to be making compromises and giving up something. I mean, I have a friend who chose to be a stay-at-home mom, and she spends all her time kind of overwhelmed by her parenting duties. Whereas, you know, my joke is that I have a job and I have kids, which means I get to screw up twice as much stuff as she does, you know? So then if you wind up choosing not to have kids at all, then you're like, well, you know, did I miss out on this thing that's a huge life-changing experience for so many women? And I think almost...
Right, and the answer to that is yes, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, and when you, especially when you get to be, I'm getting to the age where a lot of my friends are now deciding that they want kids, and some of them are discovering that they waited too late. And while some of them are okay with that, or some of them are adopting, others of them are completely freaking out. There is something hormonal that hits some women, and it just knocks them for a loop, and no matter how many times they told themselves it didn't matter, they can't quite deal with it. And so a lot of people wind up knowing friends like that, and they're like, wow, do I want to, like, have that happen to me? It's, you know, it's all this kind of ticking clock stuff that makes it all the more angsty for women, whereas, you know, Larry King can have kids when he's 150.
Right.
I wouldn't recommend it, but he can.
Well, and I mean, and so many people can. I mean, look at somebody like Christopher Hitchens, you know. I think it's incredibly unlikely that a woman could have a career like that and have children, no matter how supportive her spouse was. And she would be, you know, kind of constantly judged for going into those kind of danger zones. And, you know, I mean, it would be kind of inconceivable for a mother to write a memoir and kind of relegate her children to such minor characters without being excoriated as a monster.
Well, look what happened to Sarah Palin when she wound up having a baby with special needs, and suddenly people were like, well, she can't be Vice President of the United States. She needs to stay home with her children. Her children are all going to turn out trashy. See, one's pregnant, one's, you know, one's got special needs. What's she going to do? I mean, and that was a mild case with a woman who had a huge support network. You're absolutely correct that in terms of kind of social expectations, no matter how far we've come, it's not the same. It's and there's a lot more judging that goes on with mommies than with daddies.
You know, I always find those stories like the ones in New York, I mean, in a way kind of, or not even just the ones in New York. I tend to find the stories about parenting doesn't make you happier somewhat comforting, because mm-hmm. it's kind of like somebody out there saying, you know, okay, and so you don't have to do it. Do you think, I mean, a lot of times parents really kind of angrily object to these studies, and I'm curious about whether it's because, I mean, either because it's just kind of so contrary to their own experience, or because it seems to be kind of calling their choices into question. I can't quite tell which one it is.
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One, I think certainly there's the element of calling their choices into question. I also think that when you get older, you forget mm-hmm. how really hard it is. When I have written about this online, I always have some extremely well-meaning commenters email me to, and often as not, they're men, email me to remind me how beautiful parenthood is and, you know, how it's not always hardship and whatever. And I'm like, well, I know that. I love my children, you know, more than anything in the entire world. But that doesn't mean that it's easy or that it's not complete. You know, I think, was it Caitlin Flanagan in one of her books, you know, the kind of the grinding anxiety of parenthood. You never, unlike a project at work, I mean, I'll go and I'll do a big piece and I'll work on it for weeks and I'll sweat blood over it or whatever. And at the end, I get to spike the ball. I get to mm-hmm. have it published, and whether or not people like it or what, it's done. And I did my best, and people can you know, mouth off about it. You never get to do that with parenthood. You know, your kids are 10, 20, 30, 40. You always worry about them, and you never know if you've done the right thing. You know, they could be, you know, you have a child who's fabulous up until he's 16 and he gets run over by a train, or until he's 25 and he has a drug problem, or until he's 35. And, you know, there is no spiking the ball with this kind of thing. But as they get older, they require less kind of daily management. And I think even in Jen's piece, she talks about how the ages between 6 and 12 tend to be
or like a hiatus or something.
Parents have less stress because it's after they're so kind of labor intensive where you have to do everything for them, but before they turn into little hormonal balls of
monsters,
horror.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are kind of gaps. And, you know, my mom now laughs about the fact that she just, you know, kids reach a point when they're teenagers where you just can't stand them, and then you get to send them, you know, just as they get decent again, you have to send them off to college. So, you know, there are these periods, and I think when people get to where their kids are older and they've done a lot of the stuff, they do kind of repress. It's like you do with childbirth. You repress some of the worst stuff, or kind of the more grinding stuff. And, you know, they're your kids. You do anything for them. You just cannot imagine a world without them. But again, that doesn't mean that it's not just kind of brutal in the trenches from, you know, day to day.
Why do you think that, I mean, given that there's so much kind of latent, there's so much angst, there's so much free-floating anxiety, there's so much unhappiness, and these things are the tinder of most social movements, right? When everybody kind of has a problem and they're just, you know, and everybody's suffering and everybody's kind of waiting for someone to put a name to it. Do you think that there will ever be some kind of political response to all of this unhappiness? I mean, the other point I thought that Jennifer Senior made that was really important is that this isn't something that's inevitable, even just among kind of, you know, the upper middle class in Western democracies, and that in countries where they have, you know, whole rich arrays of social services, like I think she mentioned Denmark, but Scandinavia in general and France, people are a lot less unhappy.
Well, they're a lot less stressed out about their parenting. I don't know that I would say any Scandinavian country is necessarily less unhappy. I mean, what are the suicide rates?
Well, I mean, yeah. But. Well, although Denmark, I think, always comes out on top of those global happiness studies. Denmark and Nigeria, for some reason, which...
I don't really think that there's going to be a big social approach to this here, anyway. I mean, everybody... It will be more around the margins, you know. Can you get better daycare options? Can you get better paid leave? And I think the kind of key to that is having more daddies involved. I mean, when mommies stayed home and daddies went off, there was no question. But despite the gains made, you still have kind of a disproportionate number of women kind of staying home and a disproportionate number of men making the laws or feeling the impact. I think as that balance shifts, you'll get some good around the edges changes. But I think... you and I will probably not be around to see kind of any kind of
reap any of the benefits.
Yeah, maybe our children's children would get the benefits of that. But I do think already with kind of dads in the trenches, and you see it even in terms of kind of what's acceptable behavior for dads. Like I know a lot of dads on the campaign this last time around, the presidential campaign, who were under a lot of pressure because they were not home enough. Now, they still got away with it more than a lot of the mommies did, but it was not like it used to be when the boys on the bus went off for months at a time, and you know, their wives were making them feel it this time, and I think that will continue, and that's
the worst. To me, the one thing, like, one of the kind of big flashing horrors out there, I mean, one of the things that makes me so reluctant is to have to be the wife who's making someone else feel it. Do you know what I mean?
Oh,
to
be the definitely. Wife. The I mean, and Jen's piece talks about how the some study, it may have been out of Denmark, I can't remember where it was, but 40% of arguments are over the kids, and that was just directly over the kids.
Right, and then there's everything else about,
but everything else, you know, when you're single or when you're just married, the division of labor isn't that big a deal, you know? He leaves his socks on the floor, whatever. You cook, he cooks. There's only a limited amount of life maintenance work that needs to get done, and eventually, you know, you'll get it done. But if you throw other small people, small, helpless, really high-maintenance people into the mix who require a lot of tending and a lot of money to deal with, just the pressure ramps up and you fight over stuff that isn't directly related to the kid, but it, you know, it's like, well, who's going to take this time off work to, you know, take the car in for a service, but I took the kids to the pediatrician, but, you know, it kind of spirals, and why do I do all the laundry, or why do you do all the, you know, why do I expect you to do all the shopping? I mean, that gets much, much worse when you, the more kind of tiny little helpless people you throw into the mix.
Well, yeah, the one thing that I thought was so harrowing in that story was the man who said something like, there's nothing romantic or erotic between me and my wife anymore. Like, I love her because she's part of my family or something.
And this is really hard. I think it's usually, and I'm going to stereotype here, usually the stories are that it's much harder for the dads to adjust to, one, just feeling neglected because they are not the center of their wives' world in the way that they would like to be. And two, because everybody's just too tired to have sex. I mean, it's just like that's a, you know, not always the case, but, you know, kids are up, they're sick, and they're a lot of work, and it's not that nobody ever has a minute of free time. It's just you have a minute of free time, what you want to do is you want to shower, or, you know, you got to go to the grocery store, or you want to, like, sit down and breathe. And everybody feels it. I do happen to think that men tend to feel it a lot harder.
You mentioned, before you mentioned Larry King and his how many children? And his seven wives.
It's like a little bit like Henry.
Or you mentioned that, what's that?
A little bit like Henry VIII.
And I know, and we, this, and that was the other thing that we were talking about before we started this conversation was the end of Larry King and whether that means something broader about the end of, or about whether CNN itself is doomed, about whether the kind of, whether it's just him or whether the whole enterprise.
Oh, I think there's no question that his kind of decline is more of a sign of what's happening at CNN, just in general. And there's a lot of debate over this in terms of who's going to replace him. You know, will it be, I think he's pushing for Ryan Seacrest and see the other options are some snarky Brit and other, you know, there's lots of kind of ways and models that they could go. But it's just kind of, I think the bigger thing is it's just kind of indicative of what's going on over there. CNN's been panicking for years now. They're losing market share and they can't figure out what to do. They're going to be straight news. They're going to, but no, they're going to bring back some kind of crossfire show with Elliot Spitzer. They're just, it's kind of a combination of they don't know what they're doing. They know what they kind of want to do, which is be a straight news channel. But let's face it, you can't be a straight news channel and compete with the likes of Fox and MSNBC, which are catering to tribalism.
I actually wonder how much this is true, because, you know, I don't watch CNN. I mean, hardly ever, you know, except if I'm at the gym, and even there. But I do watch BBC, but I do watch, you know, and there's not enough people like me to make up any sort of core audience, but I do watch BBC News because it's not kind of insipid, it's not kind of constantly insulting your intelligence. I mean, to me, that's the big difference between, say, CNN and The Daily Show, for example, is, you know, on the one hand, The Daily Show, yeah, it's got attitude and it's, you know, funny and they don't have to hold themselves to kind of the standards of traditional, you know, straight news reporting. But to me, the bigger difference is that it's smart. You know, the same, I think you could say in certain ways the same thing about, you know, PBS NewsHour or some of the PBS documentaries. I mean, to me, the problem with CNN is kind of like the problem, say, with Newsweek, you know, which isn't so much that it's kind of geared towards the middle, it's that it's kind of geared towards this, like, insipid, dumbed-down kind of notion of middle America.
Yeah, I mean, which is very strange, because whereas Newsweek is catering to audiences of, you know, readerships of millions, cable news, including CNN, has never been about a mass audience. I mean,
right, which is kind
of strange.
Shows get
hundreds of thousands of viewers, or maybe, you know, million or two viewers. These are not kind of broad-based channels that we're talking about here. Mm-hmm. So it, on some level, you're right. It makes no sense whatsoever that they should be doing lowest common denominator news coverage.
But then again, it might be too optimistic of me, you know, might be too optimistic vis-a-vis America to think that they would be doing better if they were just, you know, sharper and smarter and more penetrating as opposed to, you know, more politicized.
Well, I think, I'm not sure that they even kind of know who they want to compete against. I mean, they judge themselves and they get advertisers, I think, based on kind of their standing among Fox and MSNBC. Mm-hmm. But that's not what Fox and MSNBC do. I mean, Fox and MSNBC's shows that are really popular tend to be the ones that cater to the tribalism. And mm-hmm. when CNN has tried something, you know, Campbell Brown's show, basically she said, I tried to compete and I couldn't by kind of being the nice girl in the middle or whatever, and it didn't work. Now, I guess if your argument is if Campbell had been like 30% smarter, maybe it would have, but I don't know that
30%.
They have a model for that to, I don't think that they necessarily have any kind of model that they can look at and say, well, we want to try this. I mean, I don't know what the numbers on PBS are. I mean, PBS isn't a good model for one thing.
Yeah,
PBS doesn't have to make
great
that kind of commercial decision.
Mm-hmm.
And it certainly caters to a different audience. I mean, but PBS also has the trouble of PBS's viewership is really old. And
right.
They're constantly trying to figure out how to cater to younger viewers, where, you know, obviously The Daily Show is the flip side of that. What they've got are younger viewers. But, you know, those are two completely different models, and I have no idea kind of how CNN looks at those guys.
So how, I mean, because in certain ways these are some of the same problems facing magazines, right? The kind of declining audience for deeply reported news that's not necessarily, you know, kind of either entertaining or, you know, kind of pre-digested in a partisan way. I mean, do you feel like the end of CNN augurs something? Is it, I mean, do you, like, I'm not sure if I really care, if I should really care that CNN is dying, or whether it actually, you know, whether that those kind of things actually do serve an do have an important role, and that we're going to really miss them when they're gone.
Well, I think CNN's a little bit different than the newspapers dying out. I mean,
mm-hmm.
There was some, and I can't remember who it was. I don't know if it was Dan Rather or one of the big news guys used to be pretty honest about the fact of if you wanted to look at something in great detail, you probably would do well to, like, read a big, long piece on it in, you know, one of the dailies if you wanted to get kind of really in-depth. CNN doesn't mm-hmm. do in-depth. I mean, I know it likes to think it does, but, you know, that's just not what they're selling. So I think it's a different phenomenon, but, well, maybe it's a different subset of the same phenomenon. I mean, Newsweek is different. I mean, newsweeklies are a model that in the age of the internet are really complicated. I mean, what they used to do, you just don't need anymore. They weren't, you know, they kind of took the week's news and bundled it up and gave it to you in a way that, you know, average Americans who didn't have tons of time or a ton of background in a subject could appreciate. But it wasn't stupid, but this mm-hmm. is just not something, you know, more and more that's not how people like their news, and I just, time will last, my guess is much longer than the others because it is a brand name. When somebody dies or whatever, you get your commemorative issue of Time, mm-hmm. so that brand name will take it much farther than, you know, U.S. News is already gone, Newsweek is being sold, and who knows kind of where that will go. But on some level, I don't think they've figured out the model for kind of what makes them relevant again, because they're not really opinion magazines, and they're not really deeply reported, and they're not investigative, and So they just have to kind of, what they're struggling with is kind of where they fit in. But I don't think, you know, which is a little bit what CNN's doing. But I think CNN's selling something different. So again, it's the same subset, but it's just still trying to figure out what they're doing.
Because I also don't think that whatever is replacing all of these, you know, kind of stodgy old institutions is necessarily working either. I mean, nobody I know feels that happy about, you know, except for, I guess, very young people, about this kind of endless barrage of quickly produced commentary, quickly produced copy that's like, you know, a kind of endless grind to produce that nobody can possibly be reading all that deeply just because there's so much of it out there. I mean, I have a, like, there's a sense of kind of things being, you know, kind of spinning off into greater and, you know, into these kind of atomized units that are kind of so atomized they're only being produced for other bloggers or produced for each other. I mean, that's my sense at least, which is why I'm, although, again, though I'm not a big fan of CNN, I'm also really reluctant to kind of say, you know, good riddance to all these big organizations that haven't kept up with the times. It's not like there's that many great new sources of news replacing them.
No, and I think, you know, it's a soft spot I have for newspapers where they have money that they spend to do these big, long projects and have their bureaus and foreign lands and all of this kind of thing. You need that, and that's kind of what a lot of the kind of websites and stuff then feed off of. If you don't have that, I don't know how it works. And CNN does on some level, you know, it's why when you go to a public place like a gym or a restaurant or a bar or whatever, as often as not, if they've got news on, it's CNN, because it's not as atomized as some of the others. You know, in theory it is straight news and you don't need to share anybody's political ideology to sit there and stand it. But I do agree that kind of what a lot of people like about the web, which is, you know, you could get on there and find your particular niche, is also something that I think works better if you also have a couple of kind of broader institutions out there digging for, you know, hard news and things like that. And in theory, that's what CNN's supposed to do. And as they kind of feel their way and try to get into these personalities that they're packaging and stuff, I don't know that they're going to be able to compete or, you know, kind of distinguish themselves. I have no idea. I mean, they're kind of famously badly run, too. I mean, that's one of the things that kind of gets lost in all of this, the stories of incompetence over the years, which have trickled down, are playing a part in this. It's not just kind of what they do. They get kind of panicked and do this kind of thing, but I don't know. Larry King's departure, I think, is going to have a lot of people re-looking at the thing and asking broader questions about, you know, where do they go from here and stuff like that.
You know, it's funny. The other day I was, I mean, this isn't quite about CNN, but it's kind of about the decline of, I guess, mainstream media and, you know, kind of traditional ways of consuming information. I was at a dinner party and, you know, somebody asked me what I did and I said I was an author, and he looked at me, this guy looked at me and said, "Oh, nobody reads books anymore. You should really take up video." which actually made me think that that maybe I should have a baby. since the only thing that I've ever done with my life seems to be on the way out.
Okay, I suspect I've heard worse reasons for having children. But, you know, everybody's always predicting the end of books or, you know, whatever. You know, for that matter, is TV on the way out? Because the web's going to take it over? I don't know. I think authors will certainly be expected to do kind of this cross-media platform promotions and things like that. So, but I don't think that means that the industry is going to completely disappear, or, you know, you'll wind up with all your stuff on Kindle as opposed to hardbound volumes. But,
right.
You know, it will adapt, and I think, yes, you will have to get out there and market yourself. But, you know, you can do that in maternity clothes, too. You'd be great. It's just you can do it all at the same time. It'll be perfect.
Okay, should we end it there?
Yeah, that's probably good.
Okay, well, it was nice talking to you.
Well, you too.